we're actually, I'm going to vlog the value production at the last meeting, so over to you in terms of the council meeting.
And I now give over for the concept for medical schemes.
Thanks, Tim. Maybe honorable members, let me take this opportunity to extend our gratitude to the members for allowing us this opportunity to speak to the committee about this important piece of legislation. We must indicate from the outset that as a Council of American Schemes, we are not here saying we are totally opposed to the bill. As a matter of fact, we appreciate the intention of this bill. We are just here to raise areas that we feel our related entities will find difficulties in terms of complying with those sections. As you know, or you know, Council for Medical Schemes is a legislative body established by the Medical Schemes Act. Its role is to provide a regulatory supervision of private health financing through medical schemes. The entities that we regulate include medical schemes, medical schemes administrators, managed care organizations, and healthcare brokers. And of course, our mission is to protect the interests of beneficiaries at all times. We further need to highlight that the entire relationship between a beneficiary and a medical scheme is based on processing of personal information and any other type of information as contemplated in the bill. You will realize from the presentation there from the slide that we've tried to just highlight what is happening in our daily activities. What will happen is that as a result of the contractual relationship between a beneficiary, in this context will be a principal member, you have other interactions between the scheme and third parties. What happens is that in these interactions, you have a flow of personal information. In fact, to have flow of funds and services for the benefit of a beneficiary, you also have a flow of information. This is why this field is going to be very important to our regulated entities. Of course, we have as Council of Medical Schemes hold a position that the bill is of importance, then we, to that end, we established an internal task team to engage the bill and just to assess the implication of the bill to our related entities. As I've indicated, our entities process personal information as provided for in Section 1, special information as provided for Section 26, as well as personal information concerning children, provided for Section 84 and Section 85. Of course, medical schemes will qualify as responsible parties, and you also have brokers, depending on context, they can qualify as well as the responsible parties. You have medical schemes administrators, managed health care organization, and healthcare brokers, qualifying as operators. Then, of course, you have beneficiaries of medical schemes qualifying as that subject. And as it is provided for in the bill, medical schemes, administrators and medical care organizations, in their capacity as organizations, can also qualify as that subject. We will not deal with the entire bill, but just sections that we feel the committee might need to have looked into. We have at our first proposal regards to Section 11 of the bill. As it currently is, it provides as follows, that personal information is only a process if the data subject or a concerned person where the data subject is child concerned to processing. Our proposal is that it should read as follows. The data subject or any other person authorized in writing by the data subject or a competent person where the data subject is a child consigned to the processing. And the reason for this is very simple. Medical membership is based on a single contract covering a number of beneficiaries. And when I say beneficiaries, of course, these beneficiaries can be, either be a principal member or his or her dependent. As we read this clause, the implication is that if, and I'll just give a very simple example, if our company secretary, Mr. Dixon, apply for membership to a specific medical scheme and wishes to register his dependents as beneficiaries because it's so allowed in terms of the Medical Schemes Act. The implication of this clause as it reads, say for the other requirements provided for in this section 11, is that a medical scheme to process the personal information of those dependents, either adult or child dependent, consent must be obtained directly from those dependents. And in this case, I'm talking about an adult dependent, because in as far as a child dependent, at this point, is covered, because where a child cannot, doesn't have a competence in law to consent, an adult will come to the rescue. But where he wishes, for instance, to register his wife, as a tenant. If a medical scheme can process the information of that wife, the first need to obtain consent from that wife. But here's the concern. If we allow that to happen, then it means you have a situation where there is a delay in enrollment process of that wife. That delay will obviously result in a prolonged non-medical coverage of that wife. And what happened is that for that wife to receive treatment, although the principal member being the Dixon can afford, to enroll that wife on his medical aid, but because of this prolonged processes where the scheme has to obtain the consent, her consent, and then, of course, other requirements are that she must be advised of her right to object to processing of that information. That means it has to create a process, and that process prolongs the finalization of the enrollment. And as it happens, the lady will then be forced to seek treatment in the event she so needs the treatment from the state hospital. That means how it creates a burden on a state. Now, I will go further to give another example. Now, where a medical scheme has to process claims, the bill as it is implies that before such can happen, consent from the very same dependents who are not a contractual partner with a medical scheme in that membership still has to consent to the processing of that claim, of those claims. That is a problem because you have a situation where the medical schemes are unable to process the claims, or otherwise they process those claims outside the prescribed period as provided for in the Medical Schemes Act. That in itself is a concern. Now, if our proposal were to be considered, that situation would be avoided because you now have a scenario where a member is able to consent on behalf of his or her dependent. That way we won't have this delay that I have mentioned earlier on. But again, medical schemes are, in terms of the medical context, are required to furnish similar accounts to beneficiaries. Now what it means is that if his dependent undergone a specific treatment, and now the medical scheme wants to furnish him with the account or the details, then the transaction between his beneficiary and the medical scheme would be fluid to the extent that the consent from that beneficiary has not been obtained. So this is basically a justification for our proposal. But again, I think the core justification is that a contract in any event exists between a principal member and a medical scheme. So it is not necessary to be having to go back to the beneficiary dependents for consent in order to process their information. We'll move on to section 11, subsection 2, which talks about revocation and withdrawal of the consent by a data subject. And in our context, that would be a beneficiary at any time. Well, as it reads, it says, the data subject or competent person may at any time withdraw or revoke its consent, provided that the lawfulness of the processing of personal information before such withdrawal or the processing of the personal information in terms of subsection 1B to F will not be affected. Yes, the qualification in terms of subsection 1B to F, we note those qualifications. But it's very difficult, you know, in our industry, because you have a situation where a member consents for membership with a particular scheme. Now, at the stage, because of this section, he says, I want to draw my consent for the consent I granted you medical scheme for the purpose of applying for membership. If he does so, because on our reading is that this particular member can withdraw the consent for the purpose of membership application, but still remain a member. So, to that end, we propose that if that would be the case, if a person were to be allowed to withdraw or revoke his or consent at any time, any contractual relationship or any other relationship between the data subject and the vulnerable part must be terminated forthwith. In our case, I'll give another example. We have a situation where a medical team has to process claims. And the beneficiary says, no, I'm actually withdrawing or revoking my consent that I initially given for the process of for the purpose of processing of claims. Now, you will have this member, you have this beneficiary remaining as a member. But as a medical scheme, you find yourself in a situation where you are restrained, you can't discharge your statutory responsibilities or contractual responsibilities. Yes, this person says, no, I'm not withdrawing my consent for the purpose of membership application, but only for the purpose of claims processing. Because you have a healthcare professional who will then submit claims to medical schemes. Before that, he must have consent from the beneficiary to say, well, now processing your claims, are you giving us consent? Let's say for argument's sake, the beneficiary consented the beneficiary say consented initially to the processing of those claims. But he later says, you know what, actually I have a record in terms of section 11.2 of this act to withdraw my consent. No, I'm withdrawing my consent for that purpose of claim processing. Then you are explaining the medical scheme. You can't do anything. You have a member who has undergone treatment, who now withdraws his consent. For that purpose, let's start with the person. For that purpose, he was to have regard to the qualification provided for in B to F. For that claim, let's talk about the single claim. That claim the person cannot be able to pay. But this beneficiary remains covered by the medical scheme. Then it becomes a problem going forward. What happens then? So to that end, we propose that any contract relationship or any other relationship that exists between a data subject and a vulnerable party at a time of revocation or fraud be terminated or suspended for free. that way our industry will be helped. I'll move on to talk to this committee about Section 34 and 35, which deals with processing of information concerning a child. We are aware that in terms of the definition provided for in the bill, a child is anyone less than the age of 18. They have no harm to say. But now, the only concern that we have is the following. You have a legislation granting females, for instance, if you talk about the termination of pregnancy, females of any age who are able to can give a consent to a certain treatment. And in this case, of course, with the termination of the pregnancy. But we need to realize that when that happens, the minute this female of less than 8 years sits there with a health professional and says, I've taken a decision that I'm going to terminate this pregnancy, there's a flow of information there. There's a flow of information that needs to be processed. So it is a problem. It is a problem at risk because now you cannot process that information. If you want to process that information in terms of this bill, you go back and look at the definition of the child and it says anyone less than the age of 18 must be treated by an adult person. Then it becomes a problem. You will have a situation where the medical team will be sitting with the problem of having to interpret this legislation against this legislation, and it's going to be a problem. But of course, the exemptions, we also propose that exemptions afforded in terms of Section 32 should also be applicable to Section 35. If we check Section 32, Section 32.1A. Anyway, it says the provision of processing personal information concerning a data subject of health or sex life as referred to in Section 26 does not apply to the processing by then it lists medical professionals, healthcare institutions, or facilities or social services. And I'll go to B, insurance companies, medical aid scheme administrators, and manage the healthcare organization if such process is necessary for an aid list. As it is, we wouldn't have a problem with it in terms of Section 32. But we propose this justification should also be applicable to Section 35. Because as it stands, any information regarding the child's health cannot be processed as the patient currently is. So we just propose that this justification must also be applicable to Section 35. Well, of course, we'll come to our final area of concern. Section 114 of the bill. As we understand it, it purports to say this bill will apply retrospectively. But of course, a period of 1 year will be given for compliance. Our proposal is that it should apply prospectively because of the complexity of the complexity and the size of our industry. If we were to go back and, you know, if our medical scheme is, and you were to go back to so many thousand beneficiaries to get their consent in compliance with the bill, it will create difficulties for the medical scheme. So we propose that it should apply prospectively or alternatively a third period to the maximum of 5 years. You can see that.
Sorry, Chief, can you just, that part that is just really explaining, can you just repeat that whole thing, Chief, because I didn't catch the whole thing what you were saying.
are you referring to the retrospective application of the bill, section 114?
Yeah.
What we say is that as an appendix section, the bill, the act will apply retrospectively because a period of 1 year will be given for organizations to comply. So where they will have difficulty with that because you, a medical scheme such as what, let me not mention it, let's just say a medical scheme such as Milford Medical Scheme, I have about, you know, thousands of beneficiaries. Now to say I must go back to each and every beneficiary, for instance, to get a consent so that I'm compliant with the bill, is going to create difficulties for me. Otherwise, I'll have a situation where I'm sitting with, you know, a dilemma of not complying with the bill. So, but if we were to extend that period to about 5 years, in the event the committee were to be of the view that the retrospective application, as we understand it, is the way, then we will have problems. And then, of course, a third issue would be on cost implementation as far as compliance is concerned. As the bill reads, for medical scheme to comply, it means the medical scheme needs to put in some systems, enhancements, processes, and operating mechanisms, which alone will have a serious impact on the medical scheme. And eventually, those costs will be passed through to the members through contribution increases. And of course, that will, you know, work against the whole spirit of the act, because the issue of affordability will come into play. We'll have a number of beneficiaries then resigning from membership from medical schemes because of the cost. I think that would be all, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can I have the department to respond to this proposal?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Just for the benefit of the Council of Medical Schemes, my name is Andrew Kerr. I'm from the Department of Justice Constitutional Development. With me is Ms. Ananda Lung of the South African Law Reform Commission, who conducted the investigation and assisted the department in promoting the bill through the parliamentary process. In the portfolio committee, a technical team was appointed, among others, to consider the bill. That technical committee also requested Mr. Frans Cronier to assist them, and he's also here today. You feel at any stage in the future that you would like to get an input from Mr. Cronier, and I said he is available. First of all, Chair, I think...
No, just a moment. Hello, Bukunda.
Can you just put your mic lower and then you can speak through the mic?
Thank you.
Apologies, Chair. Mr. Chair, I think what I'll do is I will, with your permission, would like to respond first to the issue raised with regard to children. It's extremely important to note. May I just add, Mr. Chair, we did submit a written representation, and I trust that the committee members had a look at that. The whole issue of children, would like to, and two issues were raised, if I understand the definition correctly. First of all, that the definition of child is not in line with the existing law, insofar as the age of consent is concerned, and then secondly, that the whole issue of the processing of child personal information must also be made applicable with regard to children. Mr. Chair, we have done very careful drafting in the technical committee when we defined the term child, precisely because of this reason that query that has been raised at this stage. we must take note of the fact that, and I'm going to use a simple example here because it's always easier to explain this by way of example. We have different ages of consent in terms of different pieces of legislation. A child of 16 years or older might, for example, open a bank account in his or her own name. So that is the age of consent that has been established for that transaction. Our definition says that the child is a person who is under the age of 18 years, but then there's a very important qualifying component of that definition. And that is to say, if that person is not competent to enter into a transaction on his or her own account, then that child must be assisted by a competent person. So back to our banking example, what our definition says, or what our definition does, it recognizes the existing ages of consent. Our definition recognizes that, in line with our banking example, that if a 15-year-old child opens a bank account, the transaction of opening a bank account necessarily involves the processing of personal information by that responsible party. If that child is not competent to open a bank account on his or her own account, then for purposes of our book, that child will be defined or regarded as a child as technically defined in our book. However, if a 16-and-a-half-year-old opens a bank account, then it is recognized that he or she may open that bank account and is therefore competent to conclude the transaction. Conclusion of the transaction, once again, involves the processing of your personal information, and our definition recognizes that. So I think it's purely a question of interpretation of the definition of child, but this is something that were extensively looked at in the technical committee, and the definition was extremely carefully drafted to fall in line with the existing law insofar as the age of consent is concerned. Because, Mr. Chair, there are various pieces of legislation that provide for different ages of consent. The purpose of this bill is not, insofar as this issue is related to, is not to amend the existing substantive law insofar as the age of consent is concerned. So that is the first issue with regard to children. The second issue that was raised is the recommendation that the specific authorization granted in Clause 32 relating to health information should also be made applicable to Clause 35.1. Chair, there's a short and a long answer, and I would like to at this stage attempt to provide you with a short answer. As I said, we have given you written submissions in response to the representations by the CMA. We feel, or we are of the view, Chair, that it might be a question of the CMS not having considered all aspects with regard to the provisions of, for example, Clause 32. Clause 32, and I'm just going to quote the introductory words for you, is the prohibition on processing of personal information concerning a data subject. That's the important definition. If we see Clause 1, if we refer to Clause 1 and the definition of a data subject, it means the person to whom the personal information relates, in short, Mr. Chair. So we would argue that the concern that has been raised has in fact actually been covered, and it's not necessary to amend Clause 35 accordingly, because the position is addressed in the specific clause, namely Clause 32. I don't know whether you would like me to proceed, or whether you would like to ask the CMS to respond immediately, or shall I just finish our response here? I will do so. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, with regard to Clause 11, the concerns arise today. I'd like to direct you to our written response, Mr. Chair. I think the important thing at this stage is to recognize that Clause 11 does not provide for one scenario only in terms of which personal information may be processed. And that is, of course, the scenario that has been highlighted by the CMS dealing with the consent of the data subject. We must take into consideration that paragraphs B to F are also available in terms of which the processing may take place, and that those paragraphs are read disjunctively. So that, in effect, subclause 1 of clause 11 makes provision for 6 different instances in terms of which a responsible party may then process the personal information. So our argument, in short, Mr. Chair, is that the consent of the data subject is not only a requirement that has to be complied with for a responsible party to process the personal information of a data subject. There are 5 other instances in terms of which the processing may also then be authorized. The final issue that was raised by the CMS is the provisions of clause 115. I'm quoting from our response at this stage, Chair. We feel that the recommendation by the CMS is based on the supposition that consent as a prerequisite for the lawful processing in all circumstances has to be obtained from existing beneficiaries is the only the prerequisite that must be complied with. Consent is not the only justification in terms of which a responsible party may lawfully process the personal information of a data subject. And then we must also take into consideration, Mr. Chair, that the law does make provision for to consider the position of responsible parties in order to comply with the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information. I may, for example, use or refer you to clause 14.4 in terms of which the reasonably practical test has been introduced for purposes of taking the subjective circumstances of responsible parties on a case-by-case basis into consideration in order to determine the extent of compliance with the various conditions. So our argument, in short, Mr. J, is that first of all, consent is not the only requirement that must be complied with in order to process personal information. There are, in addition to consent, 5 other very widely defined instances in terms of which processing might take place. The issue with regard to the definition of child, our submission is that the definition does make provision for the concern that has been expressed by CMS, and the reference to clause 114, once again, consent is not the only prerequisite that must be complied with. Mr. Chair, as I have said, Ms. Lowe is also assisting us. I don't know whether she would like to add anything at this stage, but I think we will then, at this stage, regard that as our response. It looks like Ms. Lowe would like to say.
I would just like to follow up on what you said. Just the effect of what you said is that since the bill is not consent driven, it means that if you don't want to, or if the consent provision is providing you with problems, then one would rather advise that you use B to F, and rather use that as your criteria. And then when you get to the fact that the person can withdraw the consent, then it wouldn't be a problem if you've used one of the other criteria. This would not be a problem. And also 2B stipulates actually that provided the lawfulness of the processing information in terms of B2F will not be affected. So it actually gives you that qualification in 11.2B specifically. So that if you've used B2F in 1, then 2 also refers to the fact that your processing will not be affected. So I just wanted to, it's not a viewpoint that I'm making, I'm just trying to explain the effect of what Henk has explained.
Any comments from the council?
Thank you, Chair. If I may, I'm Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Committee. Again, just to reiterate the gratitude of my colleague that you've granted us an opportunity this morning to be heard before the committee. We know the committee is very busy and we didn't wish to detain us, and so we launched straight into our presentation. I'm Craig Rosen-Durham for purposes of the record. I'm the Head of Legal Services at the Council, and my colleague Milford, who presented, has been driving the actual Protection of Personal Information Bill project within the unit since his presentation. We've also got a further colleague, Mr. Danny Corver, here, who's the Head of the Accreditation units within the Council, and they are responsible for accrediting medical scheme administrators, managed care organisations, and of course healthcare brokers. Chair, we certainly would first say the Council, as has already been said, certainly firmly and strongly supports this piece of legislation. It has a constitutional imperative, I think, that cannot be missed, and it's really just dealing with some of the smaller technical aspects that are of concern to us. It's an industry covering 8.5 million lives. It's a 107 billion rand industry in terms of the size of the industry financially. And of course, there are hundreds of thousands of transactions that are processed every single day through the medical schemes. We gratefully acknowledge the remarks of the state law advisors and have noted the reasons that they've given for the various provisions. We would of course appreciate when we back at the office, we just engage a little more carefully, you know, on some of those to see whether the concerns are addressed. However, at this point in time, just to say that the primary concern for us is that, of course, the entities that we regulate must be compliant with this legislation when it comes in. And so what we've endeavoured to do in the few really brief, crisp issues that we've identified is to make proposals for the amendments that we believe are consistent with the particular legislation that's being proposed, Honourable Chair, without in any way derogating from or doing any sort of violence to the legislation. The first you believe they'd be consistent with the aim and the objectives of the legislation. They don't seek to change it in any material form. But what they do seek to do is to provide clarity. We've heard the views of our learned colleagues from the State Law Advisor. The concern is that very often, as we know with legislation, Honourable Chair, one has a situation where lawyers then debate these things, and if it's not crystal clear, you don't want to get into a disjunctive type of purpose of interpretation of legislation. We just really sought to put it beyond any doubt. I think we're on the same page in terms of what is being said, but just to make it crystal clear, we felt that this would in fact enhance the legislation, certainly this industry which we regulate, very complex, fraught with all sorts of transactions. And so really that has really been what we have sought to do. We just don't want to be in a situation that passes into law that we then find the complexities, you know, we're confronted with it. And then you've got lawyers from all over the show, you know, applying minds to the legislation. That's problematic. We want our industry to be fully compliant with it, and therefore we believe that the proposed amendments, maybe that's something that the state law advisors can consider, don't in any way derogate from the intention of the legislation. Again, just to reiterate, we firmly support the purpose and the objectives. We're just seeking to find this, that slack on the ground, just to iron out what can be very problematic if in fact there are areas of doubt. And we cannot afford an industry that's non-compliant, Chair, under any circumstances. We've noted the comments. I think the points have been made, but I don't wish to rehash those or to traverse those specific aspects again. But those are really just our comments in terms of where we are coming from. And the State Law Advisors might invite us to make written recommendations and comments on our return. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. Can I hand over back to the department to take us through the bill?
Certainly, Chair. Thank you very much.
Hello, Gunda.
Chair, are we not going to engage with the CMS?
Are there issues that you want to raise with them?
I just
want
to ask two questions, Chair, to clarify what they just mentioned.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. On your introduction there and on mission and vision, there's a statement that you made, and it's a quite important statement, that you are there, the purpose of there is to protect the interests of the beneficiaries. I'm talking about the CMS. Of the beneficiaries of medical schemes. The reason why I put that is how often are you, let me see, monitor or evaluate medical schemes, medical schemes that are under you guys because you are Council of Medical Schemes. How often are you doing it? The purpose that you should protect beneficiaries, is there anything that you find there that beneficiaries does not benefit or that medical schemes that doesn't comply with certain issues and the policies of medical schemes, is it so that the beneficiaries can always benefit? And then the other, okay, now that one is, that one just explain it. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, if I might offer my colleague, Mr. Corbett, to respond, but before that, just to preface the Honourable Member's question, it's a very important question, Chair. So we've got a very well-developed system of compliance monitoring within the industry, and schemes are monitored on an ongoing basis in terms of compliance on a range of different issues. Various pieces of legislation of a constitutional import, in fact, of late, and we refer to the Consumer Protection Act as well, amongst others. This piece of legislation, the provisions provided for in this piece of legislation are hugely invaluable in terms of protecting members when it comes to the flow of information. Information, as we know, Chair, Honourable Chair, has been to an extent abused, you know, in the past, and I think this piece of legislation will put that to it. We have certain issues there. We've certainly dealt with that. We believe this piece of legislation will go a long way toward addressing a number of those concerns, but we just want to make sure that the provisions are, in fact, absolutely clear in terms of what is required, given the number of transactions, the complexity of the industry, and the manner in which people, the regulated entities, engage with the actual legislation. But to answer the Honourable Member's question, we have a very well-developed system of compliance monitoring. Medical schemes are regularly summoned to the office of the Registrar to give account in terms of the financial status of those schemes and issues concerning the protection of members. That is at the centre, that is at the very core of what we do, and that's something which the regulator and the regulatory authority takes very, very seriously. Chair, my colleague on the finer details, the Honourable Member, might be able to expand on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. In order to respond to the question, in the as it relates to regulatory oversight within the Council, is very similar to what you normally find in the financial services sector, where a distinction is made between, you know, the latest notion to move away from prudential supervision and market conduct. So what we practice at the Council in terms of the Medical Scheme Act is actually a combination of both in order to protect the interests of beneficiaries. Reference has been made to a single contract, in other words, the member contracts with the medical scheme in question on behalf of his or her dependents. And what we have is going back to what we do in terms of market conduct supervision and compliance monitoring is that all of those entities, Chair, mentioned on the slide there, except for medical schemes, administrators, managing organizations, and brokers, are required to be accredited in terms of rather comprehensive standards and criteria and requirements in order to maintain their accreditation as is contemplated in the Medical Schemes Act. One of those, if in order to protect the interests of beneficiaries, and given the flow of information and the manner in which medical schemes contract, you would find that, for instance, a medical scheme may contract with a managed care organization, which we attribute. It may contract with administrators. And those entities must, for instance, comply with rather rigorous and comprehensive standards for accreditation, which in behavior includes financial soundness. So we monitor that from an accreditation perspective. Medical schemes, as my colleague has said, you know, are subject to quite regular reporting, financial and otherwise. We have a risk-based regulatory framework within the office of the registrar. Medical schemes are classified in accordance with the various risks that they pose in terms of, in order to protect the interests of beneficiaries and in order to ensure that they comply with what we would, you know, refer to as market conduct or legal requirements. And therefore, you know, it's not uncommon for us to meet with medical schemes on in terms of the risk-based regulatory framework that we have, where we classify them accordingly and exercise supervision in accordance therewith. By and large, all medical schemes submit quarterly financial statements, you know, to the office as part of the monitoring process. I know that some of it is just in responding to the question.
Just a follow-up on this. I should have put the whole question together. The policies of medical schemes, are you monitoring it? Policies of medical schemes, are you monitoring policies of medical schemes?
Okay.
The next question, before you answer, and this is the last one. What are council doing when a beneficiary's personal information gets into the media through a medical scheme? I've got proof. I can give it to you. But I just want to hear what you're saying, what the council can do.
Honorable Matila and Honorable Nessie. Thank you, Chair. I'm not necessarily on the issue raised, but it's about the issues raised by the council itself. Taking into consideration the problems we are faced with in this country, I mean, I'm saying the disappearance of children of all ages, registered to medical schemes or whatever without the real parents' consent or their own consent, and it's happening en masse in this particular country because of specific challenges and problems we have that we have inherited from the community. That is one specific area. Now, and taking the way the fraudulent situation that is there within the financial sector, which will then also impact on the medical field themselves. Because I think in terms of the way the bill is written, it's trying to take care of some of those specific areas. I know your content is to take care of the last two issues you have raised. Whilst at the end of the day, your content is around the cost indication of what might happen. Secondly, if you take the 114 that you raised, I'm not sure, but I'll get back to 114. Yeah, I think it's 114 around the period. You see, because it's actually to assist you to make us fit to deal with some of the problems that are there that we are trying to raise. Because if we say it's open-ended, if the bill is the period you are trying to propose of 5 years or more, the period you are trying to raise of 5 years or more, how do you deal with all those specific problems that have been there? Because in real terms, the council does not go into those medical schemes and then check on individual applications of
what has happened previously. Because it then tells those medical schemes. I mean, we are on the medical scheme ourselves. Do you know how expensive it is? And their regulation, they're actually in terms of there's a minimum that has to be paid out specifically for whatever illness that is there, which is not even covered, because most of the money goes into what you call administrative costs in those money, into those medical schemes. And I'm just saying, how do you deal? Because the problem is and I want us you to just retire. How do you deal with the problems we have inherited, problems that have been there, that we're trying, that this bill is trying to deal with, you know, around the fraudulent situations, around what has been happening in this particular legal scheme. And then you are aware, I think you are aware of the huge unlawful issues that are taking place within the financial institution. And I take medical schemes to be part of that, that particular sector. That is one area. Because, you see, the point raised by one of my colleagues here, that is trying to indicate, is just to deal with some of those specific areas. So that yourself as the council are able to can tighten the schools and make sure that you monitor. Because medical schemes have got different different policies and that might not in any way, that you might not even have the capacity to even monitor those different policies as this particular country. Those are areas that I thought are important. And I'm saying you are aware that the child of 13, 14, 15 years, yeah, there are these problems that are there that will go and around this pregnancy problem that might approach, and the example you have just raised, and then say, I want to do away with this particular pregnancy without the consent of the parents. At the same time, the parents might go there without the consent of their particular, without actually consulting with that particular child, but just withdraw. You know, everybody else can move in and withdraw whatever consent that is there. You see, now is this bill trying to, in terms of your own? I'm sure because I was not going through the bill itself. Is it trying to protect? Because I understand you are trying to protect medical schemes. What about the individuals themselves? Because your concern is about medical schemes, the cost implications and everything else. I know you're talking about the cost then being transferred to individual applicants there, you see. But I'm not saying that it takes care of, is it a holistic approach where it takes care of everybody else in that particular medical scheme. And it's unfortunate I've not gone through the bill, and I'm trying to use whatever experience we have on the ground of what is happening with this medical scheme and everything else that is there. Those are the issues I'm trying to, because I thought this is what the bill is trying to do, deal with some of the areas we are trying to raise. These are questions that are there, raised by communities on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I have not gone to belong. I'm happy about the bill because there are things that I've experienced, and some of them I've been hearing from the communities about the beneficiaries. Now the Council for Medical Schemes, I'm happy that they're here and raising these issues. The point at 10 is what Honorable Konda is raising here. you are monitoring, and you are regulating, and you are looking at the medical schemes. To me, I don't think I'm asking, but it's a comment to say, as we speak, practically, as our practical experience, in 2003 I was involved in an accident, and then the first wheelchair was bought by the municipality I was working in because the medical aid couldn't pay MedShield, so I've forgotten the name. They couldn't pay because of the year they gave you so much. Maybe they say 16,000 and then the wheelchair is doing something. Then they say someone must pay and they will pay the difference. Then immediately when the municipality bought the wheelchair for me and then I was claiming that 16,000, they refused. They said it was not me. And then I left them. This year, I'm in permit now. In fact, I'm going to raise the permit, but I want to show you what we are talking about what we are doing. That you are here questioning the bill, not for the benefit of the beneficiaries, but for this scheme. This year I bought the wheelchair. This one. The medical aid has been in this medical aid since 2005 until now. Permit. I bought the wheelchair I bought the first wheelchair through the legislature in the UK without permit. They didn't do anything. I didn't see the benefit I didn't look at the benefit. And then later I realized when I had to buy it because that one was old. And for this one, because they renovated this one. And they bought me the new one, that is road accident fund. Now I asked them, but what is PAMA doing for this asking? What is it that they are paying? Because per year, financially, it has 18,000 for a wheelchair. So this is, I think, they are about 9. Those 18,000, I mean, if it didn't work for the first year, the other year, you forfeit throughout for the past 9 years. Now I'm saying to them, no, you can't, because this is my benefit. Pay this one, this 18,000, pay your part. Those accident is paying, they pay their part. That thing never, they'll never do that. I said, no, fine. Write it down, because I want to argue against what we are paying. I mean, you are milking out of me now. And then they refuse, they tell me about the policy. I said, but directly, the policies you are talking about. The point of making this example, Chairperson, without playing this meeting, is to say to the council, I doubt that you are here because of beneficiaries. You are not here because of beneficiaries. I mean, here is the point at hand. If you are here then because of beneficiaries, tell me of this, because there are so many cases like this one, where these medical schemes are not paying. The other part, when I had the accident, I didn't look to the contract. When you are disabled, they were supposed to have paid me, I think, 25,000. Then I didn't see that. I didn't know that. But when someone was looking through the contract, 2 months after, I mean, because it has a period where I should have claimed that money, we realized that I didn't do this. We were trying to ask them. But we didn't know, and I was in accident. They said, no, mentally, you were right, everything was right, you should have known. And if that man, I couldn't get it, and I said, no, it's fine, I don't need the money, the accident was an accident, I didn't want to fundraise out of myself. So I'm trying to say about these examples that I'm making. They are practical examples, which have happened to me. Remember, I'm one of at least the people that are advantaged because I've went to the university. Talk about those poor ones who do not know, don't have even the airtime to call, because if you call the Mexican, the Mexican will send all of them. You spend, I think, 20 minutes from airport from hotels that came to the township. Someone said to me, wait. The very same people of this Mexican. Tell me, how about this? I mean, what will happen to the poorest of the poor? That is my concept, as to say, I'm trying to be with Honorable Gunda, that to say, I doubt that you are here because you are concerned about beneficiaries, as Honorable Martin said. You are here because you want protected things. And here are the examples that I'm making of the very same things that we are here for them.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Member. I think the issues that you have raised, even though they are significant, but they are not related to the debate, and I will urge you to take them further with the councillors they are here. And I will ask you not to respond to some of the issues that have been raised, so that we allow the department to complete their presentations, and then we will engage thereafter. You can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, there's just an accommodation problem at this stage. I would, if I could, kindly request the gentleman in front of me to provide us with space, because we would like to show you a PowerPoint, or that is part of our briefing. Mr. Chair, while we try to doing the connection, I just wanted to point out that there was also a representation made by BMI with regard to clause 109 of the bill. We have responded to that as well in writing and extensively, and I think if, unless there are any questions flowing from that, I assume that matter has also then been finalized. So I would rather not waste time on responding to those issues. As I have indicated, we have submitted written a response to that. Mr. Chair, while Ms. Lowe is setting up her computer, and fortunately we've got a few introductory words that we have to do before we really get to the PowerPoint presentation, the slides that we have prepared for the members forms part of the document, the workshop summary. We've titled it the workshop summary. Those slides or annexes 1 to 6 are at the back of the workshop summary, which we have provided you with, and the aim of those would be to give us a broad idea of how the provisions of the bill stick and how they work. But if I may, Mr. Chair, just by way of brief background information, I would like to mention, just once again confirm, that this bill flows from an investigation by the South African Law Reform Commission. That investigation was requested by Parliament in 2000 when the Ad Hoc Joint Committee on the Open Democracy Bill approved the Promotion of Access to Information Act. The committee requested that the whole issue of the processing of personal information, privacy and data protection should also be investigated. So the request for this legislation came directly from Parliament, and it was already stated this morning that it aims to give effect to a certain extent to Section 14 of the Constitution, of our Constitution. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to bore you with too much detail with regard to the problem statement. I think that issue, and that is on in paragraph 2 of the workshop summary, I think those issues are straightforward. I would like to just briefly mention as well that internationally there are extremely many countries who have privacy and data protection legislation. It is essential for South Africa to also come in line, not only internationally if we refer to the European Union, etc., but there is an African Union Convention also on its way, dealing with cybersecurity, and a very big portion thereof relates to the protection of personal information. There is roughly, if I remember the statistics correctly, Ms. Lowe researched that for us, there is already 11 African countries with privacy legislation, and a further, I think, 27, including South Africa, that are in different stages of enacting the privacy legislation. Mr. Chair, I've just covered paragraphs 1, 2, and 3 of our summary. I would just like to briefly refer to the current legal framework. private privacy is protected in terms of Section 14 of the Constitution and in also the common law. The law of Delict provides a solid basis for data protection but cannot be regarded as providing adequate protection. Legislation incorporates internationally accepted data protection principles, or what we refer to as the conditions for lawful process, is therefore required. Although there is a small overlap between the PPI Bill and PAHIA, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, insofar as the latter provides for the specific limitations to access to personal information, the bulk of the privacy principles are not included in PAHIA. PAHIA does not, for example, provide for the collection, distribution, security safeguards, detention periods, etc., of information. I mentioned the Promotion of Access to Information Act early on, Mr. Chair, because we will see as we go through the bill, and especially when we get to the portion dealing with the establishment of the information regulator and the powers, functions, and duties of that regulator, that the provisions of PAHIA or the Act itself will then also come into play. So we have to just possibly keep in the back of our minds that we do have the Promotion of Access to Information Act, which is also relevant in this regard. Mr. Chair, if I could possibly indicate to you that the key aspects of the bill are the following. It is essential to promote legislation in order to introduce a framework for privacy and data protection. The bill is therefore a general information protection statute. It's applicable to both public and private sector, covers both automatic and manual processing, and will protect unidentifiable natural and juristic persons. My apologies, I nearly said unidentifiable. we are now, possibly if we can, show the next aid you, Mr. Chair. Annexure 1 in the workshop summary is at the back of your...
Yes, Mr. Member, do you have the document?
Yes.
Just now on page 4 and 5.
Thank you, Chair. I would possibly recommend that we also have a look at page 16 then. Chapter 3 of the bill deals with the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information. That chapter is divided into three parts, part A, B, and C. Part B deals with the processing of special personal information, and part C with the processing of personal information of children. Now, Mr. Chair, if we look at the next one, we note that the conditions for the lawful processing, as they are stipulated in Chapter 3, are applicable to all responsible parties. Responsible parties are, of course, defined as public and private bodies. There are 8 conditions that must be complied with, reflected in clauses 8 to 25. A very important aspect to note, and we have already during the CMS submission referred briefly to that, is the whole issue of exemptions, exclusions, and exceptions. The exceptions are provided for in the conditions for lawful processing of personal information. Experience of many, many years of the application and implementation of legislation in the European countries, etc., have indicated to us that if you have a condition like you may only process personal information if you collect it directly from a data subject, there are various justifiable instances in terms of which a responsible party cannot comply with those issues. So what has been done is to put these exceptions into the relevant conditions where they are applicable. You will note that those exceptions are very wide. legislation. That is the exceptions. So that is one place where you will find that if you cannot, under any circumstances, as a responsible party, comply with the condition, there are justifiable exceptions that are provided for in terms of which you will then not have to comply with the specific condition. With regard to exclusions, I would just like to briefly refer you to Clause 6 of the Bill. Clause 6 of the Bill provides those instances or circumstances where a responsible party do not need to comply with the provisions of the Bill. The clause is straightforward, Mr. Chair. I don't think there's much that we need to refer you to there. Maybe just to use a practical example, one of the examples is that if processing is for purely personal reasons, then a person who may have qualified as a responsible party do not need to comply with the Bobby Act. This is also then in line with the European Union Directive. We also have exemptions. Now, the issue of exemption is where, let's say for example, a responsible party aims to comply with the conditions, cannot find his or her position in the exceptions, but for some other valid reason can still not comply with the relevant condition, but must simply price its personal information, then that responsible party may approach the information regulator for an exemption to be granted to that responsible party. Those provisions we'll find in clauses 37 and 38 of the Bill, where the regulator may exempt the processing of personal information, and those clauses also provide an indication, clause 37.1 introduces the requirement of public interest, and then clause 37.2 aims to give us an indication of what that public interest should be regarded for in terms of the Bill. Mr. Chair, just to get back to our slide then, section 1 on page 16, what we have now briefly done is to provide you an explanation of how the conditions for lawful processing should be applied by responsible parties. It is generally, internationally, all over the world accepted that those eight conditions, if it is possible to comply with them, and, well, compliance with them promotes and is simply nothing else than good business practice. Insofar as the lower part of this slide is concerned, dear Nessa, I'd just like to quickly point out to you that we have the Act and the regulations, we have sector-specific legislation, and then we have codes of conduct. With regard to the Act, or the Bill when it will be enacted, and the regulations, issues in terms thereof, and all of the sector-specific legislation, supervision and enforcement thereof will take place directly through the regulator. Then we also have codes of conduct, which will be enforced or applied by adjudicators, which have been appointed by the specific sector for which a code of conduct is then issued. Now those three blocks, the active regulations, the sector-specific legislation, and codes of conduct, I need to just briefly give you an explanation of how those three components will fit into each other. We should take into consideration, Mr. Chair, that the bill presents framework legislation. So it will introduce those broad provisions dealing with the conditions. The application thereof, the regulator will also be empowered in terms of the bill to issue the regulations that will assist with providing more specific detail with regard to the application of the conditions. A very important second aspect is also that sector-specific legislation may also be promoted by Parliament to give more effect and better and more clarity with regard to the application of the conditions in this specific area. Codes of conduct is a very useful tool. Those codes of conduct will be approved and issued by the regulator and also provides for sector-specific rules to be applied. That would mean that if there is, for example, a sports sector and they have to comply with the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information, they are at liberty to approach the regulator in order to give them more detail with regard to the application and implementation of the conditions by means of a code of conduct that will be issued by the regulator. The code of conduct will have the power of law to the extent that it will be recognized as subordinate legislation in terms of this act. So it will be fully implementable and applicable. What will usually happen where there is a code of conduct is that an adjudicator will be appointed to settle disputes that may arise in terms of the application of the code of conduct for a specific sector. We have now referred, Mr. Chair, to the information regulator, and there is and I am now on page 17, which is our annexure 2. And with regard to the information regulator, we would like to point out three important aspects insofar as it relates to the information regulator. First of all, to give you an indication of the structure of the information regulator, and then also to give you an indication of the powers of the regulator and which will deal with supervision and then enforcement with regard to the provisions of the bill. Annexure 2 on page 17, Mr. Chair, it gives us an indication or gives us a graph of the structure of the information regulator. The establishment of the information regulator is dealt with in terms of chapter 5 of the bill. This portion then relates to clauses 39 to 54 of the bill. In short, Mr. Chair, the information regulator will be appointed or established as a juristic person who will be accountable to Parliament. The President will appoint the information regulator on recommendation of the National Assembly. The regulator itself will consist of 5 persons or members, namely a chairperson, and then 2 full-time members, and then 2 members who may be appointed either on a full-time basis or on a part-time basis. It is important to note that the regulator will also be divided into 2 separate sections, if I may call them so. The bill requires that 1 member must take the responsibility for the application of the Protection of Personal Information Bill, and the other member must then take responsibility for the application of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. That is very important to note, Mr. Chair, because as I have mentioned earlier, the Information Regulator will exercise certain powers, functions and duties in terms of this law and the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Insofar as the administration of the regulator is concerned, the administration will consist of a chief executive officer as the head of administration and the accounting officer for the regulator, with all the responsibilities and duties that go along with that, among others, compliance with the PFMA Act. The staff will also be appointed by information regulator, and provision has been made. It's difficult at this stage to speculate whether it will be used or not, but a provision has been made for the regulator if the regulator is in a position where it needs the assistance to request for discontent of certain civil servants to assist in the establishment of the office of the information regulator. However, since it's important that it is necessary to establish an independent regulator, those secondments will purely be of a temporary basis for a specific purpose and will not be subject to any lengthy extensions. The administration of the information regulator will also consist of specialist consultants, which the regulator may then appoint for purposes of either investigating certain matters or to assist the information regulator with regard to specific matters being dealt with by the regulator. Provision has also been made for committees to be established. The first important committee that will be established is the Enforcement Committee. And Clause 50 specifically deals with the establishment of the Enforcement Committee and prescribes how the membership of that committee should look like, Mr. Chair. Suffice to mention at this stage that the chairperson of that committee will then be a judge or a legally qualified person, precisely because of the nature of the work that that enforcement committee will perform. Provision is also made for other committees to be established and will consist of members of the regulator designated to serve on those committees and then other persons appointed to assist the committee with its work. Now, if we look at the annexure to the slide that we have at the moment, I think we have covered the whole gist of the structure of the information regulator for the members to meet. Mr. Chair, of course, I'm not going to bore you with the detail, but the other provisions in that chapter, we find them in many pieces of legislation where institutions of this nature are created. You will, for example, see in Clause 41, it deals then with the appointment, the term of office, and removal of the members of the regulator. I think those type of provisions are quite straightforward. Clause 42, for example, deals with vacancies. And then the remuneration allowances, benefits and privileges of members and staff, which are, for example, dealt with in terms of clauses 46 and 47, respectively. The next slide will take us to the supervision provisions provided for in the bill. Mr. Chair, one should take into consideration, and if I may put it bluntly, the regulator will have many functions to perform. reform in terms of this legislation, most important of which is to note that the regulator is not only there to enforce or to ensure compliance, to enforce non-compliance and to ensure compliance. The regulator will also have a supervisory function, and part of that will be to ensure that responsible parties comply with the provisions of the bill. Now, if we look at our slide, at the top we have then the supervision as a heading. Supervision will... Supervision will be conducted on two levels, by the information regulator and by the information officers. Just a brief word on the information officers, Mr. Chair. You will recall the term from the Promotion of Access to Information Act, which provides that information officers are those heads of public bodies, but in the private sector as applied in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, we have the heads of private bodies. We find the similar terms in this bill, which means that an information officer will be regarded as the information officer of a public body and then also the head of a private body. One could possibly just finalize with this portion of the slide just by indicating that those information officers will then be responsible for ensuring that the bodies for which they work, public or private, comply with the provisions of the bill and then also deal with requests received in terms of the bill. That is not an entirely new function because it is something that is required for the past 10 years, 13 years in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So those functionaries are already operating and it's not something that will place an extremely heavy or new burden on the respective bodies. The information regulator plays an important role with regard to the Protection of Personal Information Bill and will also, in view of the proposed amendments reflected in the schedule to the bill, with regard to the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Now, to provide you with an indication, Mr. Chair, of the provided information regulator will be affected in case of various approaches. First of all, it would be noted that the information regulator will be empowered to issue regulations to provide more detail with regard to certain aspects of the bill. For example, the information regulator might issue regulations regarding the processing of health information by certain responsible parties, the responsibilities of information officers, the manner and form in which data subject consent must be requested, etc. Prior authorization is also an important tool in the hands of the regulator to determine whether the responsible parties comply with the Act prior to any complaints even. It is important to note, Mr. Chair, that there is no registration process in terms of this bill where a responsible party must register with the information regulator. So it removed that possible criticism regarding red tape and bureaucracy, etc. But it requires a process where prior authorization must be obtained by responsible parties, where they process personal information under certain circumstances. The rationale behind that is to ensure that where there is a greater risk for the interference with the protection of personal information of data subjects, that prior authorization must be received from the information regulator before that information is processed. And that is to ensure that the regulator gets the opportunity those issues or those provisions regarding prior authorization we find in clauses 57 to 59 of the law. In clauses 60 to 68, we have the whole issue of supervision by means of codes of conduct. A bit has already been said about codes of conduct, but as you said, it's useful to be used for responsible parties to ensure that the processing practices and the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information, if I may put it this way, speak to each other within their specific sector, and thereby then, of course, promoting compliance with the legislation. Just to briefly refer to, I think I'm going to interrupt myself because in the next slide I will speak a bit to the adjudicators being appointed in terms of the codes of conduct. The regulator will also be empowered to conduct assessments of the processing practices of responsible parties, and which will ensure that or have the benefit that if such an assessment has been conducted, the responsible party will have the assurance that as far as those practices are concerned, they are generally in line with the provisions of the bill. An assessment can be conducted by the regulator on its own accord or at the request of a responsible party. And Mr. Chair, maybe just from a different point of view, I personally think that the assessment is actually a very good provision or mechanism that is available, which responsible parties may use simply to find out whether they are in line with the provisions of the bill and what to do in order to get themselves aligned to the bill itself. Apart from the codes of conduct that may be issued by the regulator or approved by the regulator may also issue guidelines, and those guidelines will be an aid or a tool to be used by specific sectors in order to determine how they could go about in eventually getting their codes of conduct approved and applied in terms of the bill. In short, those are the supervisory provisions then of the information regulator and the information officers insofar as the protection of personal information is concerned. Now, with regard to the Promotion of Access to Information Act, at this stage, merely to indicate to you, Mr. Chair, that prior to the enactment of this legislation and at present, the certain additional functions have been assigned to the South African Human Rights Commission in terms of the Permission of Access to Information Act, and those functions will now be taken over by the information regulator. The regulator will then also be responsible for the enforcement of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. The next slide is a very lively slide, Mr. Chair, and hopefully a very exciting one, because I think we are now getting to the practical application of what Zibalu is all about. Well, at least in my view, I know my colleague from the South African Law Reform Commission may want to differ from me there, but the enforcement of the bill is very important. And if we look at the enforcement, there are three distinct approaches or categories that are available. The first is the administrative process. There's a second category, which is the criminal court process, and a third category, which is the civil court process. Where there is an interference with the protection of the personal information of a data subject, there are, strictly speaking, two processes which the data subject may follow. Number approach the regulator with a complaint, or if that interference with the protection of the personal information of a data subject has given rise to damages being incurred by the data subject, that data subject might also follow what we term here the civil court process, in terms of which the data subject may, through the courts, claim damages from the responsible party who interfered with the processing of the personal information. The third category is criminal court process. There are a number of offences that have been created. They are reflected in clauses 100 and up to 106. Mr. Chair, and then also, if I remember correctly, in clause 47, an offence. In any event, the provision is there. The offences that have been created in terms of the bill mainly aim to provide for issues like the obstruction of the regulator, breach of confidentiality duties, the obstruction of the execution of a warrant also by the regulator, the failure to comply with certain notices issued by the information regulator, and there are also offences that can be committed by witnesses who are subpoenaed to appear before the information regulator. All those offences have been provided for and were in the introduced version of the bill and were approved by the National Assembly accordingly. However, Mr. Chair, I would just like to point out, as a matter of interest, clauses 105 and 106. Deal with unlawful acts by responsible parties in connection with account numbers. Those two offences have been inserted at the request of the technical committee that considered the bill. Get back to our slide, Mr. Chair. I would like to go over now to the second portion, and that will deal with the administrative process. Now, to point out to you that insofar as enforcement is concerned under our administrative process component, we should note that this issue is complaints driven. In other words, a data subject must either submit a complaint to the information regulator that there was an interference with his or her personal information, or if a code of conduct applies in a specific sector, then that complaint must first be submitted to the adjudicator. The adjudicator will then settle the dispute between the parties. If, however, one of the parties is not satisfied with the decision of the adjudicator, then a provision is made so that one could appeal to the regulator for the regulator to consider the matter afresh. However, if a complaint is submitted to the regulator has once again various functions that might be performed when a complaint is investigated. Just to briefly indicate to you that the regulator may issue an administrative fine with regard to the alleged offence. I will refer you to that one a bit later again. If the regulator finds that the complaint might be better handled or is more appropriate within the sphere of activities, area of jurisdiction of another regulatory body, the regulator is at liberty to refer that complaint to the other regulatory body. The regulator may also decide, for example, to take no action in respect of the complaint. However, it is important to note that that decision may not be taken willy-nilly, Mr. Chair. The bill provides clear guidelines when a decision not to take any action may be taken by the regulator. Then the regulator may also, if it appears that it is possible to reach for the parties to the complaint to reach a settlement, the regulator may also endeavor through mediation, conciliation, to secure a settlement between the parties if it appears to the regulator that it is possible. But the important part is the full action part, Mr. Chair. So if we could go to the next portion then of our slide, we will give you an indication that if a complaint has not been submitted to the regulator and all the other steps that the regulator may take does not present a proper solution to the complaint concern, then the regulator may take full action. And full action will consist of the regulator issuing an information notice to the responsible party, in terms of which the responsible party will then be called upon to respond to the complaint that has been laid or submitted to the information regulator, and then also to give an indication of whether the responsible party comply or do not comply and what the reasons for that are. If the regulator, upon receipt of that information, finds that there was, for example, interference with the protection of the personal information on the top of the subject, the regulator might issue an enforcement notice. The enforcement notice is very important because the regulator will then direct the responsible party to either stop with the specific practice which is unacceptable or to take certain steps to become in line with the conditions, etc. Provision is made for a person or a responsible party who has been served with an enforcement notice to launch an appeal against the enforcement notice. However, if an appeal is not launched and the responsible party persists in not complying with the enforcement notice, then and only then we find that a criminal offence will have been committed in terms of the bill, and that may lead to either a conviction or an administrative fine being imposed. You will recall, Mr. Chair, that Blackmun Investments raised certain issues with regard to administrative fines. The only thing that I would like to mention at this stage is that those two options that we have, either a condition or an administrative fine, are both mutually exclusive. Either the one or the other may take place, and that will depend on the exercise of discretion by two separate entities. Insofar as administrative fines are concerned, that is for the regulator to decide whether the regulator wants to issue an administrative fine or not. Insofar as convictions are concerned, the normal criminal process is being followed to the extent that it is the National Prosecuting Authority, after investigating by investigations by the South African Police Service, who will decide whether a prosecution should be instituted or not. And then if it leads to an eventual conviction, then it is entirely up to the discretion of the court to impose a sentence. The reason why I'm belaboring this point, Mr. Chair, is that those are exactly the points that were raised in the BMI submission. And we have submitted that in our response to the representations made by them, is that the first important thing to note is that the administrative fine and the criminal process, that they are two separate mutually exclusive processes. If you pay the administrative fine, you cannot be prosecuted on the same set of facts. If you pay the administrative fine, you will also not receive a previous conviction. But it is for the responsible party, it's up to the discretion of the responsible party to decide whether that fine should be paid or not. If decide not to pay the administrative fine, then the only responsibility or obligation which the information regulator has to comply with is to hand the case over to the South African police force, and then the normal criminal processes will follow. Mr. Chair, I think that brings us to our fifth slide. Deals with the whole issue of adequacy. And I'm going to address you on that, but I might want to request Ms. Lowe, if I have addressed you on this, to possibly mention one or two things also with regard to this slide or lecture, because I think sometimes, for some other reason, to leave out some important facts as far as adequacy is concerned. But we should take note of the fact. And I think we're reaching a stage where we can conclude what this bill is all about. And I might just take up a few more minutes of your time, Mr. Chair. The whole issue of adequacy is extremely important. Firstly, it should be noted that our international instruments, for example, the EU regulation, etc., requires that a country must provide adequate protection for the processing of personal information. And adequacy involves important aspects to the extent that all responsible parties comply with the legislation. All responsible parties must comply with the conditions for the processing of personal information, and all responsible parties, when complying with the conditions for the processing of personal information, must do so at every stage during the information cycle. Now, the information cycle, Mr. Chair, deals or starts with the collection of personal information. And as we know, information in your possession goes through various stages. It might be that it will be stored, it will certainly be used, it will certainly, in most cases, be distributed to other responsible parties, and might even eventually end up in the archive. But the process only stops at where the information is destructed. So the information cycle starts from the collection and then ends at the destruction thereof. But during that whole process, all responsible parties will have to comply with the conditions. And then what adequacy you also have to comply with is that and separate entity for the enforcement of the legislation is required, and that is exactly what we have done by the establishment of the information regulator. You will note, and I'm sure that you have noted, that clause 72 deals with the transfer of personal information across our borders, and that is also where the whole issue of adequacy becomes important, because in short, what that provision, in line with the international requirement, provides is that if personal information is transferred to a responsible party in another country, then the responsible party do so must make sure of the fact that there is a system in place which provides for the adequate protection of the personal information of the data subjects concerned. Mr. Chair, I don't know whether Ms. Lowe would like to say or add anything here. Yes, Mr. Chair, I think from my side, I would like to maybe conclude here, but I would like to provide Ms. Lowe with the opportunity maybe to mention a few issues to you which I may have missed, and if so, I apologize for that.
So I think that Henk has mentioned, has done a good job of giving an overview of the whole goal. I'd just like to add a few points just maybe for clarification purposes. I think it's important to note that worldwide information regulators aren't really seen as policemen. The idea, and because it's a new field of law really everywhere in the world, although we are about 30 years behind, but it started off in other countries, and I think we should also start off where they started off and not try to emulate them as they are at the moment. But it started off really as proactive legislation. So what's important in this regard is that the information regulator should be proactive and look at systems rather than try to be a policeman. And you will see that a lot of the supervision, for instance, is really focusing on that aspect of the whole of the job of the information regulator, and that is to ensure that proper systems are put in place. Because if the systems are in place, then if you put the proper system in place, you will ensure that millions, if I think about the medical aid schemes, of people's information is dealt with properly. If you work on being a policeman, you will deal with one issue at a time, one complaint at a time. So it will be one person that whose complaint is being dealt with. So in that sense, it is important to note that the law is really proactive in nature, and it is ready to put systems, proper systems in place. I think what is also very important is it's not the idea of the law is not to stop the flow of information, it is to regulate the flow of information while the processing is taking place. So it will never stop the flow of information, it will just show a responsible party the way in which to deal with the information while processing it. Even where prior authorization is concerned, what should be, I think, just taken note of is the fact that if there is a code of conduct in place, then prior authorization is not necessary. And I think to get to the point of code of conduct, I think it is a very important tool, and in other countries it is shown that in different sectors there are always codes of conduct for all the major sectors, like for instance the health sector, financial regulators, the direct marketing sector and so forth. So it's very important to have those codes of, irrespective of what happens in the ball, irrespective of where you can see yourself in this exception or that exemption or whatever, a code of conduct is really something that you cannot do without if you are a regulator, a responsible party in a specific sector. So I just want to emphasize the importance of code of conduct in this whole framework, because it is framework legislation and it has to deal with health and education and regulation and direct marketing and whatever else. It is impossible to deal with all those issues, particularly in the law. Those issues will have to be dealt with in regulations or in codes of conduct. To comply, we looked at adequacy. What I just wanted like to say there is that the law quite often refers to adequacy. For instance, it will say that you are excluded if you provide adequate protection for of the personal information of the data subject. Now that is really the point of the whole bill, is to provide adequate protection. And that is why it's so important if we look at the information cycle that adequacy should be determined at each stage of that information cycle for all responsible parties and of all the conditions. What is very important about the conditions is the condition, complying with the condition doesn't mean that you have to comply with the first subsection of that condition, because mostly in the first section it says you should do this or you shouldn't do that or whatever. You should also comply with the qualifications, the exceptions within that condition. So indicating that you are complying with the condition doesn't mean that you are complying only with the prescript. It also means that you are complying or that you see yourself, you found yourself in the qualifications to that condition. And then you are complying with the condition. And that's an important thing that people sometimes get. They only look at the prescript, and they don't look at the qualifications that are included in that condition, which forms part of the condition and forms part of the compliance with that condition. Adequacy is then also very important with cross-border transfers, because you are not allowed to send information to a country that doesn't have adequate protection. Because otherwise, with the electronics being as it is, you can send all your information to the country next door where there is no protection of information, and you can do all your business there and then just send it back afterwards. So to prevent those kinds of privacy havens where it's possible to do all your business in another country next door and then not comply with the bill at all. To prevent that, this is why Clause 72 was included. So it won't be possible to do that. And then just insofar as enforcement is concerned, I think we must just make sure that you understand that the enforcement in terms of PPI inquiry is not the same. I think on page 19 that has been indicated. The criminal book process and the civil book process is not available for PIA. It's only the administrative process that has been dealt with. And again, there's no prior constraint. You would see that you need a complaint to be lodged before any of the administrative process will take place. I think that's more or less it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I can just make a last statement, and I just want to add to what Ananda and Inka stated with regards to adequacy. It's also important for South Africa to have a piece of legislation that does have internationally adequate data protection embodied in it. Specifically with regards to our trade with the EU, specifically, and some of the Asian Pacific countries that are out there, because one of the requirements from their side is also that you can't trade with the country. And in terms of like the cross-border data transfer flow of information, if that country doesn't have adequate data protection legislation. So like for instance, in Europe, they've got like what they refer to as the Article 29 Working Party, that has like a white list of countries that has like adequate data protection. And I think that's maybe also something that needs to be stressed, that before we even start that road in terms of like adequate data protection, it still has to be added to a specific white list. Like for instance, if you take New Zealand, that have had like data protection legislation since the beginning of 2000, they were only added to that list, I think, last year, if I'm not mistaken. So there's still a long road forward for us. In terms of data protection, and the sooner we actually get there, the better for us to get onto those various lists, because it does have like certain economic influence on the country.
Yes, I would just like to add to that. I think that also emphasizes the fact that the bill is not about restricting the flow of information, because if you can get onto that white list and if you are regarded as a country with adequate legislation, then it actually enables you the free flow of information. Then information can flow to South Africa from South Africa to any other country without any provisions on that. So you are regarded as a safe country, and any country that actually enters in trade with you can send information without any problem. Whereas at the moment there are quite a number of prescripts that you have to comply with if you want to send information to South Africa. That would then fall away. I just want to also add on page 5 of your document. Although the EU has been a leading country in this whole issue, and they have these adequacy requirements actually have an influence on the whole world, sometimes some countries were not happy about it, for instance the USA, but they have to toe the line. But it is not really, at the moment, one cannot say that it's only the EU that is really driving this force, because if you look at the institution, the international instruments referred to there, it's the EU, it's the OECD guidelines, you find these specific conditions and the exceptions and so forth in the UN guidelines, the APEC framework, which is the Asia-Pacific countries, the Commonwealth model laws have been drafted for this purpose, and also the AU draft convention on cybersecurity, which I believe the justice ministers of the AU have now approved. So it is really, it is not something that just comes from Europe. It is really now being accepted worldwide in all the international institutions. And, you know, it's almost impossible to not abide by the prescripts that are being suggested.
Thank you very much. Honourable members can engage with the presentation. Last time we said you must engage with the FSB on those two issues that they raised. You only agreed with them on one issue. Then this other one, why? I think they will table the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, possibly we've seen that the FSB is here. We were able to we have had engaged each other on different occasions. We had a few meetings. We also exchanged ideas. in Raikou. We were able to reach an agreement with regard to clause 72 to the extent that we will have to propose an amendment to clause 72 in order to then give effect to the agreement that has been reached, and we will point that out to you when we go through the proposed amendments that we have submitted to you. So with your permission, we can do that at the latest stage. However, with regard to clause 38, I think there's a few things that I need to mention to you. And I'm going to ask Ms. Lowe also to, after I have said what I think I need to say, to add if she feels that there's anything that we need to mention to the committee at this stage. However, I think it's important to note that this issue has now been debated among the parties for nearly 2.5 years. And in the technical committee, as well as the portfolio committee, the amendment or the introduction of clause 38 was then based initially on submissions that were made on behalf of the FSB. The FSB was not satisfied with that provision and wanted to add to it. If I say they were not satisfied with the provision, one would rather have to qualify that by saying they would have wanted further amendments to that provision. However, that issue was pointed out to the technical committee as well as the portfolio committee. The portfolio committee and the technical committee expressed its concern that the proposed amendments to the clause 38 were too vague and requested that a specific indication must be given of those activities in terms of which compliance with those provisions would be not possible, bearing in mind the wide exceptions being provided for in the clauses. We raised similar concerns with regard to the proposed amendment of clause 38, and by giving an indication to our colleagues that it would be extremely difficult, and not only difficult and impractical, but to a certain extent nonsensical, to include wide terms with regard to the actions being which cannot be performed in compliance with the specific provisions for which they have been granted an exclusion from the provisions of the bill. We did indicate to our colleagues that we are not entirely opposed to the amendment of Clause 38, but that the very important issue is that any further amendments to Clause 38 should relate to specifics, must specifically be defined in order to ensure that the character of Clause 38 remains the same. Because just briefly take into consideration, if you have wide exceptions and you have an exclusionary or an exemption clause, which is also very wide, then strictly speaking it does not make sense to have the second provision. That in short, Mr. Chair, is the point that we have reached. We have actually only recently, and if I remember correctly, I think it was during the course of last week, around about Wednesday or Thursday, received an indication from our colleagues that they are willing to agree, or that they are agreeing with us with regard to the proposed amendment of clause 72, as I say, it was many meetings that we held and long and extensive discussions. But unfortunately, at this stage, we have not yet reached an agreement with regard to clause 38, primarily based on the fact that we haven't received the answers that we were looking for throughout our whole process. Thank you. I I don't know whether Ms. Lowe would like to add something.
I think it's covered it. I think the core question is what is it that the FSB is not able to do, taking into consideration the exceptions provided for in a condition. So if there is something, some function or some duty that are unable to perform as a result of this act, which are not covered with by the exceptions and cannot be dealt with in, maybe if they seek more clarity in the code of conduct through the process prescribed by the Act, then that would be something that could be considered to be inserted in Clause 38 as an exemption from the Act. But if they are not able to indicate what is that they have a problem with, then it is very difficult for us to include that specific issue in Clause 38. It's not possible just to say that maybe there will be a problem with something in future, because the Act is really so wide and the exceptions provided for in each clause is so wide that you know, it's not possible to include a no-wide provision in 38. So I think that would be the problem.
That
would
be.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I'm Janine Bonagiose from National Treasury, and I have a colleague from the FSB here with me also. We'd just like to also add just a few comments on the discussion in relation to Clause 38. We have certainly had some extensive and very helpful engagement on that clause, and they have certainly helped us to much better understand the particular concerns that the Department of Justice has. And we hope that they have also been gaining appreciation of some of our concerns. In relation to the aspect that was raised about the wanting to better understand a particular function that cannot be performed, we had most recently been engaging late last week and on Monday via email to try to provide some clarity on that. We will try to provide further clarity on that. And we had also submitted some proposed wording on Monday that had endeavored perhaps to more better refine the scope of the additional function that would need to be hopefully encompassed under the definition of relevant function in terms of Clause 38.2, and we had not yet received a formal response regarding the content of that particular that particular proposal, and we had also not received a formal response that the most recent information we had provided regarding the functions that may not, or the specific exemptions that may not be applicable would not be, you know, did not provide further clarity and assistance. So we certainly appreciated the engagement, and we hope that there might be a bit of scope for some further engagement on that regard. I hope that we could come up with something that might be agreeable. I would just also like to note, having just had sight of the proposed amendments, I am a little bit confused about the proposed amendment that's indicated under Clause 38.
Can you reserve your comments?
Yes, well, I just wanted to note that we had not been aware of that there was going to be any other proposal made in that clause. So we're just, you know, this might be something also that we may need to engage with the Department of Justice on. Perhaps I don't know if my colleagues may also have some comments.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Nong Guchong from the Financial Services Board. Chair, first of all, just to thank my colleague from the National Services Board for having a sort of outlined the process. Just to work the committee and to assist the committee on our engagements with the Department of Justice, and share out the high level and assist the committee members. The agreement on Clause 72 was struck between the FSB and the Department of Justice colleagues on the 4th of March already, in a meeting that we had with them almost immediately after we met with this committee, and this committee had directed us to engage. So we had a meeting and we looked through the current position, and we looked at what further can the FSB do in order to ensure that it accommodates the concerns of the bill with respect to the sharing of information with external regulators. And we found each other at that meeting. In other words, that was already in March done. And to now come back to Clause 38, Clause 38 was indeed inserted in the Act as far as my understanding, and I'll dare say my colleague's understanding as well, was inserted in order to assist concerns that had been raised by the FSB, and it was a clause that was inserted to look at what exemptions can be placed in the Act in order to ensure that financial services regulations can be catered for in the Act. It is therefore a clause that I think the technical committee actually did say that we need to engage with the Department of Justice colleagues to ensure that we are able, because that was after we had engaged with the clauses that provide for the conditions for the processing of personal information, where it was clear that the exceptions that are in those clauses do not cater for the activities that the financial regulator engages in. I've sort of prepared a little summary here, so I'm going to read a little bit from my notes, Chair, if you can hear me. The FSB's current mandate in terms of the Act is to supervise compliance with laws regulating financial institutions and the provision of financial services. In doing so, the FSB needs to have access and it needs to continuously process information and quite a number of times with other regulators as well. Currently, the provisions that are in the current Section 38, Chair, they are not unhelpful. However, those provisions, Section 38 is currently sent, it assumes, in order for exemption to kick in, it assumes the occurrence of a particular wrongful event, in other words, a financial loss, a dishonesty, in other words, it assumes that there will be a certain event that happens in order for activity by the financial services board to be exempted in terms of that section. However, the activities of the financial services board are not always based on the occurrence of such events. The activities of the financial services board, as I say, they are proactive in a whole lot of the time, and not reactive, and this requires the ability to have access to information and the ability to process that information so as to enable ongoing compliance with the laws and ongoing supervision of financial service providers. If I can kind of summarize, I would say that the committee is challenged with balancing two rights, balancing the protection of the rights of data subjects to the right to privacy from a constitutional perspective, the right of privacy of data subjects. However, the committee is also challenged with also balancing that with the rights of such data subjects who are consumers of financial services that are provided by data subjects that operate in the financially regulated space. It's a fine balance, Chair, that just needs for accommodation, because there hasn't been any stage where National Treasury, as our department, and us as the Financial Services Board, have not appreciated the reason and the utility of this particular legislation. But it is also necessary to balance the protection not only of the privacy of the rights of the data subject, but also the rights of the consumers of financial services that are provided by the who operate in the financially regulated space. Okay. Ms. Lowe and Mr. T were going on with their presentation, which was helpful. There were also indications to the provision of adequate protection of information. In other words, if there needs to be adequate protection by the whole input of the app, the adequate protection of information. Now, in our engagement with our Dragon Bush Justice Court, we have proposed the existence and insertion in our own legislation of a regime that adequately protects information in a manner that mirrors the protection of information bill, so that we are then able to say to our justice colleagues, our legislation protects information that we process and that we process with other regulators. It protects it in a manner that mirrors this legislation. Therefore, so that we can then begin to say the room then to include the financial sector, the core financial services activity in the section 6, for instance, in the exclusion section and exclusion provisions that are contained in section 6. That is where we are, Chair, and that is where we have not received a response. That is where the developments of the discussion are currently. And I would say, from the perspective of explaining to our justice group what it is that we're saying, what activities that we're talking about, we have exhausted that explanation perspective from the perspective of just advising them that it's not only for purposes of reacting to events that have occurred, it's for purposes of having access and the ability to process information and process information as a result. Thanks.
Thank you,
I think I would like to give an example to better explain the way in which the bill works. And that is to say that you can regard these provisions that are being provided in the bill, really you can compare that to the ordinary traffic rules that you find on the roads in South Africa. The traffic rules are there for the cars on roads. Because there are cars driving on all the roads, you need traffic rules to deal with those, to deal with the traffic on our roads. Having the traffic rules doesn't mean that you want to keep all the cars in the garage. It is precisely because everybody's driving around that you need the traffic rules. Now, in the same way, this bill is not meant to be a hindrance for a responsible party to process information. It's precisely because information is being processed all the time that you need the rules. So the rules will just be regulating the processing of the information. What happens is sometimes you would have, for instance, on some occasions, the hospital will come and say that we have ambulances driving on the road. I'm back at the traffic rules now. And in some instances, when we are carrying a sick person to hospital, we cannot comply with the traffic rules because we need to drive on the left hand, you know, on the past the red robot or whatever. What we want from the FSD is to show us why they are an ambulance. Why are they not part of the ordinary traffic rules? And that is what we have not received. We don't know why they should be regarded as an ambulance rather than all the other parts that are driving on the road. Because the traffic rules are not there to stop the flow of information, and all the wonderful work that the FSD is doing is not under any threat by this regulation. Just as all the cars driving on the roads at the very moment are not under threat of the traffic rules, they are actually being assisted by the traffic rules. Saying that you have to stop at the red robot and you have to drive on the left-hand side of the road doesn't mean that you're not able to drive your car. It is actually assisting you to drive your car better. And in that sense, if you look at these rules, it is good business practice. That is why we also say that if you have good business practice in your organizations already, then you wouldn't even have to change what you're doing that much. Because it is general good practice that is being described in the Act. There are no draconian prescripts in it. And that is where we have our problem in our discussions where we could not get further is that if we look at this whole issue as traffic rules for the traffic out there, we want to know if you want to be regarded as ambulance, then you can write in here ambulances when they are carrying people to hospital. They don't have to comply with traffic rules. When they are just driving around, maybe from one place to another, they don't have a person inside, they don't have to comply with the traffic rules. And that is, it is specific. It is a specific issue that you have to show us why you should be regarded as an ambulance rather than as an ordinary person driving on the road. And why should the traffic rules of the cyber world not be applicable to you?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just in response to the department's views on this matter, I think from our side, Chair, we are quite confident that we have actually made our case to the department. Hence, eventually we agreed with the department that we'll be exempt from Section 11, 12, 15, and 18. That is when we went into the specifics to say why we don't want to be bound by the traffic rules, as Ananda has put it. I think the issue that we had with regard to Section 8 as it stands currently is that it provided us with the specific exceptions to those four provisions, yet it limited the ability of the FSB to exchange information or to process data in respect of other functions that it performs. As we said, Chair, that the FSB is a non-banking financial regulator. It is South Africa participating in international standard-setting bodies. It is a member of the G20 and the Financial Stability Board, where cooperation and exchange of information is emphasized in efforts to have a consistent and effective regulatory framework globally and locally. Hence, we were saying to our colleagues that in addition to limiting Section 238 to only where we are protecting members of the public, and the FSB, and not only the FSB, but also other regulators, like the South African Reserve Bank, we fulfill other functions as regulators. We have got a role to ensure that there is financial stability. We exchange information with our regulators to ensure that the people that are managing our financial institutions are fit and proper. We also have got a responsibility to ensure that there is financial market integrity, fairness, and efficiency. And all those are key functions of the SSB, are core functions of the SSB. Yet when you look at Section 38, it only limits us to sharing or processing information, subject to those exceptions, of course, only where we are protecting members of the public. And Chair, I think my colleague also from the Council for Minister Edkin also touched on the issue of market conduct and prudential regulation. That is, I'm not sure if maybe the committee is aware, but the FSB is moving into the BIMSTEC regulatory framework. Then we'll be looking specifically at issues of market conduct and prudential regulation, where exchange of information will be key, simply because what the Reserve Bank is currently, the functions that are currently performing in terms of the bank will be split into market prudential and market conduct and prudential regulation, where some of the aspects of the bank will be regulated by the Financial Services Board. How then do we not exchange information, personal information, with the Reserve Bank on those aspects where we not only protect the public, but we want to make sure that our economy is stable, our financial system is also stable, that our financial markets are fair and efficient. So I think that's where we the point of convergence is for the department. Thank you.
Thank you. The FSB chairperson read clause 38 to propose a reactive provision. That is not my reading of the section, chairperson. If maybe they can explain to us how it is reactive, because my reading is that it is such that you can be proactive as well. It says in any case, to the extent to which the application of the provision to personal information will be likely to prejudice the property charge of the transaction. And it continues to say, which is performed with a view to protecting members of the public. Again, so, Chairperson, you can be proactive with that section. I don't read it as being only reactive. You can use that provision in a reactive way. And I didn't get the name of the last speaker from the FSB, but she mentioned certain functions of the regulator that include other international bodies. But I don't see those functions as being as a requiring an exchange of specific information of data subjects. It will be general information. I don't see if you improve regulation, you would be specific as regarding specific data subjects. Maybe I can probably enlighten us on that issue.
Thank you, sir. I think I would like to address the last question. The fact that in exchanging of information or assistance to other regulators, we do not share personal information. Chair, I can promise you that we exchange personal information on a daily basis. That as I speak to you, I had just exchanged information with our regulators in Jersey, in Benzi, in the SSA, US, UK. We exchange information, and this is now, Chair, personal information there. Requests that we receive would go like this, Chair. They would say, we have received an application from Mr. So-and-so. Mr. So-and-so wants to be a financial services provider in the UK, and we would like you to confirm, since we know that this person operates in your market, we would like you to confirm that this person is fit and proper. And then what we would do as the FSB, we would ask for ID numbers, would ask for any other personal information that can assist us in checking that that person is fit and proper. Also from our side, Chair, we do find receive applications from entities that operate cross-border, and we also want to be comfortable that we want to accept people who've got integrity in our market. So what we do simply, we just also say to our fellow regulator in US, UK, wherever the entity is based, this is the application whether it is, this is the name of the person, these are the ID numbers, every personal detail that could assist the other regulator in assisting. And also what we important here, I think I need to emphasize it, in all our requests, it is standard procedure that we would have safeguards to say, the information that you give us, or that we give you, we give it to you in terms of an MOU. You are under no circumstance should you disclose the information to the third party without our approval. That thirdly, you must keep the information confidential and use the information for the purpose for which it was sought. It is our standard letter. It's unfortunate that I don't have it with me, but I can access it on my iPad. That's to show the committee that we do have safeguards when we exchange information, and we do exchange personal information with regulators. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Matthew.
Sorry,
Matthew. The lady from Tellarif here.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just wanted to add just a couple quick points based on the previous submissions from colleagues. As has been noted, key considerations that need to be understood in relation to an overall effectively and functioning stable financial system, which have been referred to, are prudential regulation and market conduct regulation. And prudential regulation can be understood as regulation in order to ensure the safety and soundness of financial sector institutions, focusing in particular on their ability to meet the financial promises and obligations they incur in the course of carrying out their business. And market conduct regulation can be understood as regulation in order to ensure that financial sector institutions conduct their business, both their internal business processes and external consumer-facing activities, in a way which is consistent with and advances the objectives of consumer protection and fairness and integrity in financial markets and confidence in the financial system. And if you don't have both of these types of regulation operating very effectively within the system, that overall the stability of the financial system can potentially be seriously compromised. And in order for financial sector regulators to be able to fulfill these critical regulatory functions, there is on an ongoing basis an extensive need for sharing of information regarding financial entities and also sometimes particular individuals within their entities to be able to properly assess their practices and their soundness and whether or not they are complying with legislative requirements. And overall, internationally, there is a move for the increasing interaction and engagement between financial sector regulators. For instance, in Europe, there is a move to set up a model for how the financial sector regulators should be engaging in terms of legislation and sharing information and what sort of arrangement they should be putting in place between each other in order to be able to appropriately then be able to exercise their functions. And the way the current Clause 38 of the bill is framed, it does capture quite a few of the aspects of relating to market conduct, relating to consumer protection, and the impact on consumers specifically. But it does not really address aspects of how you could monitor business processes, and also it does not address fairness and integrity in financial markets and issues that impact on the confidence in the financial system. And also, Clause 38 does not really address a lot of the aspects relating to prudential regulation, which are overall critical. And in the European regulatory draft regulations, there is a recognition that there are key financial interests of countries which may potentially justify that there needs to be some exemptions relating to the exchange of information. And we have been trying to appropriately identify these important financial public interests, particularly crafting them around the definition of prudential regulation and market conduct regulation that I have just described, so that then those aspects could particularly potentially be incorporated as an aspect of an appropriate regulated function that would then be more specifically regulated in terms of the financial sector legislation. And we have crafted a clause that would be inserted in the Financial Services Board Act and ultimately would be incorporated in the Twin Peaks regulatory framework that would endeavor to provide an appropriate framework that caters for the that balances the rights of protection of personal information and adherence to the principles, while also recognizing the important need of the financial sector regulators to be able to exchange information rapidly and regularly and on an ongoing basis. So these are the important issues that we will be seeking to address going forward within the financial sector, and they are very critical aspects of the functions of the regulators. And so if Clause 38 can potentially encompass these aspects of prudential and market conduct regulation appropriately, then we would think that would be a very appropriate provision in the legislation. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I've been covered by what Justice Brewer, because just in reaction to the proactivity that is required with respect to the function.
Thank you, Jane. To the extent that our interaction with the Financial Services Board may likely assist you in taking this matter forward, we have made reference, Jane, to the fact that we accredit inter alia brokers, healthcare brokers or advisors, in terms of, in essence, dual regulatory provisions. Because what we do at the Council for Medical Schemes is to grant accreditation, however, and that is important as it relates to the submissions made by Treasury and the FSB. In terms thereof, and we didn't delve into the nitty-gritty and the finer details, but as part of that accreditation process, we engage with FSB on a daily basis. We have approximately 9,000 financial advisors, between 7,000 individuals and more than 2,000 organizations who, in terms of dual regulatory provisions, must be fit proper, as declared by the Financial Services Board in terms of the FICE Act, Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act. To the extent that, for instance, one of those entities or individuals may be found by the Financial Services Board who licensed them as financial services providers not to be fit and proper, they can impose a legal sanction, like withdrawal or suspension of the license. Now, that sort of information is communicated by and between us on a regular basis. Otherwise, we would have had to impose or to double up, so to speak, on the provisions and financial advice act in order to execute the functions and statutory requirements of the Medical Schemes Act. So, and Chair, based on that information, I think the FSB and the Council of Medical Schemes are both in very much a similar situation, the ham in a sandwich, so to speak, proverbially. Because if, for instance, we allow an entity to function and be accredited or licensed, and that entity is not fit and proper, there may be, and I think there was a test case before against the Financial Services Board in terms of some class action on investments and so on and so forth. But I think the fact of the matter is that, we rely on personal information on exactly the same basis as my colleague from the FSB explained to yourselves, the exchange of information between the regulators. And based on that information, we often impose severe legal sanctions, which we can, by, for instance, closing the business of a brokerage or a broker firm or an individual for having or failure to comply with vice requirements, fit and proper, comes in, what they were saying in terms of value from Treasury, both prudential and market conduct arrangements. And, we do rely on that information in order to either accredit or license or not to accredit, or failing which, we impose statutory sanctions. I just thought, we vastly may not have specifically dealt with this in our presentation. I think, having listened to the discussions, I'm sure, my colleagues and I would, could probably take a position in support of the arguments by the Financial Services Board and by Treasury. Thank you, Jay.
I would like to respond immediately to what the gentleman on my right has said, and I want you to just think again of what he said, and then I would like to ask him a direct question to which I would like a direct answer. And that is that when you refer to the functions being performed by his institution, which is extremely important, a creature of statute, those functions are performed in terms of legislation. There is no function that can be performed at present in law that is not, to an extent, an obligation imposed by law. So my question would simply be, and you will recall, during what he said, he referred to at least two or three pieces of legislation which empowers him to perform, or which empowers his institution, which is a creature of statute, to perform certain functions, powers, and duties. So my question would simply be at this stage whether those functions being performed, and this is my question, are they as a result of an obligation imposed by law on the CMS?
Yes, indeed, clearly. It is a statutory provision. It's compelling in nature. And as I explained, it is by virtue of statute that we do that, and in terms thereof, there's a cross-referencing to being fit and proper as contemplated in the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act, hence the daily exchange of information amongst us and the Financial Services Board.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would just like to point out the support given to the FSB in what has been mentioned by them and just by the CMS is based on the exclusion in clause 38 from four provisions, 11, 12, 15, and 18. Now, it's off, and I would like a direct answer, once again, to a very short, direct question. In clause 11c, processing complies with an obligation imposed by law on the responsible party. Why would you require an exemption or an exclusion from that clause if you have just confirmed that you are a creature of statute, perform those functions in terms of obligation imposed by law? Why would one want to do that?
Mr. Chief, Honourable Members, let us allow the debate to flow. I'll give you a chance.
To raise is, we are raising this matter in as far as clause 8 is concerned. Now, what we wanted to find, particularly from the department, was this matter not raised in as far as the deliberation in the National Assembly is concerned, and what were the answers, so that we can, we are able to, so we don't start from scratch, we are able to, can, you know, this can lead us somewhere, because the way it flows, it's the discussion is among themselves, and it excludes ourselves as members. We are not sure as to what is happening, and if we have an answer from that point, we are able to, can, you know, intervene and deal with this specific matter.
I agree with the Honourable Speaker. We are at problems in legislation, and now we've got a difference about breeding. I'm living in the spirit of legislation, but other people are always looking at the letter of it. So I don't know, I'm going to be led by the officials. So I'd like to ask that go back and clear this clause 38.
Thank you, Chair. I think for the benefit of the committee, Chair, it would help if probably Anana or Hank would clarify where the discussion with clause 38 comes from, because the exemption that is required is not the same as the gentleman is referring to. If you are within the Republic and you are exchanging information as a regulatory body, different provisions apply to you. So there are different provisions of the Act that already cover the scenario. So that section wouldn't apply to that arrangement. So it would just help the committee to understand better the deliberations of where clause 38, the clause 38 discussions came from.
And that was explained earlier, and we said they must not put us. We don't want to say the department is wrong or FSD is right, but they must go and further engage so that they make it easy for us. But seemingly they have not agreed, and I think it is now up to us as a committee to decide the way the deliberations will unfold. And I think I would suggest that we close the matter at that, and the committee in its deliberations, with the assistance of the parliamentary legal advisor, will finally and you'll be really informed. Yes.
I'm sorry, but I wanted to raise it a bit earlier already, and I forgot. I actually, to try to understand the position, I tried to look at regulators, financial regulators worldwide. And I have a few of them here. For instance, in Australia, you have ASIC, Australia Securities and Investment Commission, who I believe do more or less the same job as the FSB in South Africa. It says here, this is a security statement. ASIC must comply with the Privacy Act 1988, which regulates, among other things, collection, storage, use and disclosure of personal information, either information principles. And then they go on and they explain exactly how they implement the Privacy Act in Australia. So they are complying with the Privacy Act. Then we have the FSA, this is the Financial Services Authority in the UK. It says here, this is their statement, FSA data protection policy. This is a statement of the data protection policy adopted by the Financial Services Authority. I just want to go to this end. We fully endorse and adhere to the principles of data protection as set out in the Data Protection Act 1998. That's the English UK Data Protection Act. So this is Australia, this is the UK. Then we have the the Securities and Futures Commission in Hong Kong, established in 1989, independent body set to regulate securities and futures markets, etc., etc., their functions. There it says it's policy statement, privacy policy statement. Our pledge, we pledge to meet fully recognized standards of personal data privacy protection in compliance with the requirements of the Personal Data Privacy Ordinance, PDPO. In doing so, we will ensure compliance by our staff with the strictest standards of security and confidentiality. And then they, again, indicate data collection, use, retention, accuracy, security, access and correction. Then we have the authority, this Marche Financiers, that's France, in France. Once again, they say the AMF website is recorded under number 106820 of CNIL, C-N-I-L, that's the Commission Nationale Informatique et Liberties. That is the Commission, the Information Commission in France. So these are just four examples that I've managed to get together. I can go into more detail and find others as well, but I thought I would take one from Europe, one from Australia, one from the Eastern, Eastern, and one from UK. And they all say that they comply with their data protection legislation, which is in essence the same as ours, because we use the same principles as are being internationally accepted. And they comply with it 100%. So that is why I'm still coming back to the question is, why is it not possible? Please indicate. It's no use indicating how much processing you are doing, how much sharing of information. That is run for more. That's your top. That is the way that you're supposed to do that, and you're doing it in terms of the bill. But why are you not able to comply with the bill as it is, taking into consideration all the exceptions that are already built into the Act? And that is the question. Not how much processing you are doing, but why can't you do it in terms of the bill, like all the other financial sector regulators that I've just referred to?
Honourable Matila.
You see, the question I thought we are going to deal with, because I wanted to agree with you, but the matter is with the committee, that the committee then move forward. Some of the investigations we must do as a committee, as to those foreign countries, how do they communicate information to us? How do they deal with that specific situation? And we must do it, because you see, every institution here would want to protect their own terrain and do things their own way. Which I think is wrong. We must create a law that is going to assist and guide this country for the future, and then open. You see, whoever deals with whatever information is an individual, you can tell us that an individual is proper, is sound, is whatever, it will go to a certain extent, and at the end of the day, you have a lot of problems, you see. Now, that's what we must deal with, and I thought our own legal department to assist us with that particular information, rather than these institutions coming to us and telling us this. It's unfortunate that the department has now given us this particular background, because that's one of the questions I wanted to ask, as to how does those countries, if they are protecting, they are doing the same thing in terms of legislation, how do they then, I'm not asking you to tell us what must happen, I'm saying our own institutions. Internally in Parliament. Yes, thank you very much.
Do you want to say something before I, because I have to give over to the department to present the proposed amendments.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm going to be very brief, Chair. Just to respond quickly to Ananda, Chair, that yes, indeed, all these countries, they've got privacy legislations which they are obliged to comply with, Chair. But we have confirmed that we exchange information on a daily basis with all the jurisdictions that the department has just outlined. But currently, we do not have privacy law. How indeed is it done? How is it that they are able to give us the information and we are able to give them the information if their privacy law does not accept them or does not have the necessary exceptions to allow them to exchange information with us? What that simply means, Chair, is that the fact that they say they comply with privacy doesn't mean that they are not exempt in the respective privacy law, and it doesn't mean that they are allowed to use the information however they please. What they mean is that if I decide to exchange information with South Africa, I will make sure that South Africa complies with the safeguards that are in my privacy law, and which is what we are also saying. They are saying we don't want to exchange information, or we don't want to comply with the Act. We say, allow us to exchange information, and we'll ensure the necessary safeguards are in place to make sure that better information is protected. Thank you, Chair.
Can you continue with the proposal? Can you also be brief, please?
Yes, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Chair, the document that we have submitted is dated 20 May 2013. Most of the proposed amendments, Mr. Chair, are purely technical, here and there correctional spelling mistakes. A substantive amount of the proposed amendments aim to refer reference to 2012 to 2013. They are self-explanatory, and I, strictly speaking, do not really have to bore you with the detail in that regard. I am going to point out one or two for the benefit of the committee, and then I also need to point out to you, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Kinnis also at some stage prepared a document where a number of issues were raised by him. We have responded to those issues, and there are two aspects that we would like to draw your attention to, in respect of which we would want an indication from you whether we should proceed by inserting a proposed amendment or not, but I will highlight them after I have discussed this document that we have submitted to you. Mr. Chair, with regard to Clause 6, that is purely a technical amendment, more language than anything else. I don't need to bore you with the detail there. Clause 18 is the next amendment, and that is on page 16, once again a technical amendment. Clause 38 I'm going to skip for a moment, and I'll go to clause 40. That is a correction of a spelling mistake, Mr. Chair. Clause 44 incorrectly refers to principles of information processing, as those as that term was used in the bill that was introduced in the National Assembly. The term was replaced with conditions for the processing of personal information. So on page 27, in clause 44, we want you to please approve the proposed amendment that we just replace an old term with the appropriate term. Clause 72, as we have indicated, Mr. Chair, the proposed amendments there are now based on the agreement that was reached between the Department and the National Treasury with regard to the provisions that were included in the National Assembly. But we have now reached the position where we can give effect in our proposed amendment to the agreement. And if I could possibly just summarize to you what the proposed amendment entails, if you look on page 37 of our bill, in clause 72.1a, if those provisions are affected, that paragraph will read, the third party who is the recipient of information is subject to a law, binding corporate rules, or binding agreement which provides an adequate level of protection. That, and then Romans 1 and 2 follow. Subclause 2 will be omitted. Subclause 3 will become subclause 2. Paragraph A of subclause 3 will be omitted. And paragraphs B and C of subclause 3 will become paragraphs A and B, respectively. That is what the proposed amendment entails there, Mr. Chair. Clause 99 is a consequential amendment as a result of the agreement that was reached between the parties. Clause 106, the proposed amendment there is just to improve the language of the bill, incorrect spelling there. for Hammerson 15, and this is now the bulk of the remaining provisions. The bill still refers to the Protection of Personal Information Act of 2012. We have taken this advice from the state law advisors, and they have indicated that their reference to a year with regard to the act only occurs once or twice in one or two places in the bill. That could be administratively corrected. However, since we refer on a number of occasions to the number of the year, it may be more appropriate under these circumstances to request the committee to approve the proposed amendments. So I'm on page 3 of the proposed amendments, Mr. Chair. The number 10 proposed amendment is just to bring the private sector obligations in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act in line with the public sector obligations which exist with regard to manuals, etc. Mr. Chair, the remainder of those proposed amendments are purely technical in nature. With your permission, I would just briefly want to refer to two issues that have been raised by Mr. Kinnis and with which we at this stage agree. I have prepared a document, Mr. Chair, in table format, referring to the issues that Mr. Kinnis has raised. I have quoted in verbatim. And then in the third column, we provide our response. So we've numbered them, number 1, 2, 3, and 4. Number 4 is the proposal with regard to which we would like to receive the committee instructions, please, with a view to preparing amendments. That issue relates to clause 24 of the bill, where Mr. Kinnis indicated that, and specifically clause 24.2a and c, Mr. Kinnis indicated that the committee should consider whether it is appropriate to place time limits on the correction of information applicable to both the regulator and the data subject. Our response was a requirement that a correction should be effected within a certain period may be introduced, but it is submitted that a specific period, for example, within 48 hours after having received the request for correction, should be avoided. And our reasoning is that it is submitted that it may be more appropriate to require that a correction should be effected as soon as reasonably practical. A phrase like this would be better suited for inclusion in the framework legislation such as the EPI bill and will be consistent with the use of the phrase in other parts of the bill. The introduction of the aforementioned price will also ensure, and this is very important, a balanced approach and will accommodate a case-by-case analysis of what the required period in individual cases should be, not only with regard to the fairness towards the data subject, but also fairness towards the responsible party. That was, so our recommendation would then be that we can prepare an amendment for you in that regard, but rather to insert the phrase as soon as reasonably practicable. And may I maybe get your discussion in that regard, you said. And then the second issue with which we also agree with Mr. Kinnis is with regard to the authorization concerning a data subject's criminal behavior, that is the clause 33.1. Mr. Kinnis indicated that the processing of information by law enforcement agencies like Zenzit, however, clause 33.2 can be considered too wide-ranging because it allows preemptive data processing if the responsible party for the unlawful purposes to protect the legitimate interest. Our response was to indicate, Mr. Chair, that subclause 2 formed part of the introduced version of the bill when the clause defined criminal behavior as, among others, criminal convictions. That definition has been changed. So criminal convictions are not regarded for purposes of Clause 33 one as criminal behavior. We point out that the term criminal behavior, as defined in the current version of Laws 52, does not include the reference to criminal convictions, and we therefore submit that subclause 2 could be omitted from clause 53. So that would be the second recommendation that we would like to make, and if approved, we'll include it for you in the amendments or the proposed amendments to the bill. Mr. Chair, come back to clause 38. We have realized that, and we are of the view that we have actually nearly made a fatal mistake when we refer in clause 38 to the whole of clause 11. If you look at subclause 1 of clause 11, those are your enablers. So in other words, those are the provisions that provide you with the necessary authority to process personal information. Strictly speaking, one cannot be excluded or exempted from those provisions because they are actually authorizing in nature what should be focused on is then, of course, subclauses 3 and 4, where it deals with the objection to the processing of personal information, and those are actually the important two subclauses with regard to which the specific exemption should be applicable. Yes, Chair, that is the sum total of the proposed amendments that we have to submit to you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, this brings us to the end of the meeting. We will request you to have all those proposed amendments plus the two that have been submitted in the maybe for the last time, see if you can find each other with FSB. But if you don't find each other, as we have indicated, we will decide and pronounce as the select committee all those issues that you are not agreeing on. Honourable Matilda.
I want to agree with you. I want to request that in terms of the amendments, particularly the substantive ones, but that I thought everything else, that they effect those amendments to the bill that underline them in terms of the current bill, so that we are able to can take decisions as a committee. Thank you. Also, if the proposal put forward by I like what was said by the, not necessarily the FSB, but by the treasurer. If they can effect something of that nature into the bill, or if there are other bills that can deal with some of the issues that are raised by other institutions, so that we are made aware of all those issues, and we are able to can take decisions in as far as that raises.
Thank you very much. Do you want to say anything?
Thanks. Can I just turn up from you? I'm not taking any, I don't understand that. You don't seem to be talking to a presentation, for the department to consider the proposals.
Consider all the proposals. Yours included.
Oh, no, I had, expressed mention of
all
Thank you, Chair. Might I just ask, as part of your process, Honourable Chairperson, if we could, we only received the written responses from the State Law Advisor this morning. Is there a possibility of us engaging and writing to them to just try and obtain some sort of clarity on it? It's been difficult, obviously, to respond at the short notice. We'd also like to assist the committee, the Honourable. settled with as far as we are able. Thank you, Chair.
Again, but to want to list with this.
Okay. Yes, if we might thank you and respond formally to them, we could give you an opportunity just to do so, given that we only saw their responses this morning for the first time when we arrived here. Thank you.
Mr. Chu, the question has been directed to you directly, and I'm not, I think, at liberty to answer that question on your behalf. But I would like to point out, Mr. Chu, just generally, that this process started more than 10 years ago by an investigation by the South African Law Reform Commission, who consulted extensively and widely. The portfolio committee set aside 3 days for submissions on the bill. The portfolio committee has also expressly indicated to other interested parties who wanted to come at a very late stage by indicating to them that you are aware of the fact that this legislation is on its way, not for a year or two, for many years. My only concern, Mr. Chair, is that this is now the oldest bill in Parliament. It has been in Parliament for 3 years. I would most probably have to take instructions at some stage as to how much further engagement we would have to comply with. Because, Mr. Chair, tomorrow another party comes in, and to be put up a big fight with regard to framework legislation, I think simply is just not worth it. Thank you, Chair.
Jesse?
Chair, let's stick to your proposal. The department must abide by the committee decide. And it's not there for the department to decide here, even if the bill is how old, what the full committee is done. We are a different committee, and we are the NCOP. And it's just fair what the gentleman is asking. He's not asking something else. He's just asking, why did you send me a thing this morning? And he's asking that I want to communicate with you. Is it possible? He's not asking any trouble. So why is the department making issue out of it? Why doesn't the department want to engage with it? Because they are sent the proposal to us, and we will still decide.
I think you have told this matter. I think everything else, whether it's the department, whether whoever wants to make a presentation, this matter is with the committee. It is the committee that will decide what to do, and nothing else, you see. Even the department can't tell us anything better than this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
I can see from the title.